Welcome to the Economics Explored podcast, a frank and fearless exploration of important economic issues. I'm your host, Gene Tunney. I'm a professional economist and former Australian Treasury official. The aim of this show is to help you better understand the big economic issues affecting all our lives. We do this by considering the theory, evidence, and by hearing a wide range of views. I'm delighted that you can join me for this episode. Please check out the show notes for relevant information. Now on to the show. Hello. Thanks for tuning into the show. This is episode 179. In this episode, I chat with my old friend Darren Brady Nelson about his recent Spectator Australia opinion piece on the Reserve Bank of Australia. Darren's piece is titled, "The RBA, Reckless Bank of Australia Needs a Radical, Not Reserved Review." While Darren's article focuses on Australia's central bank, the issues considered are relevant to central banks around the world, such as the US Federal Reserve and the Bank of England. Before we get into it, I should note that Darren's coming from a non-mainstream school of thought known as Austrian economics. While it's outside of mainstream economic thinking, I think the Austrian perspective is valuable nonetheless. It's forced me to confront some of the things I take for granted about the modern mixed economy, such as fiat money and the existence of a central bank at all. I've had to think more deeply about whether they make sense. Please stick around to the end for some additional thoughts from me. Okay, let's get into the episode. Darren Brady Nelson, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been a while now, actually.
It has. Yes. I've given you a break, Darren, and I've tried to get a broad range of guests on the show. But yes, good to have you back on the show to chat about some recent work that you've done. So work in both public finance or fiscal policy, you could say, and monetary policy, Darren. So we've got a monetary policy review in Australia at the moment, and you've written a piece on the monetary policy review. And could you just tell us what your thoughts are on that review, please?
Well, look, just to step back slightly from that, you know, I've kind of been disappointed over, you know, probably the course of a decade or something like that, that obviously it's good to have a variety of different takes on things like the Reserve Bank, or obviously, you know, this review that's, you know, nearing the end, I believe the reporting to government next month. But there's just never been, you know, look, I'd love to see kind of more of an Austrian take on things, at least once in a while in the Australian media or even in Australian think tanks. To tell you the truth, I'd settle for a bit of a Chicago take on things. And you just don't get really neither of those takes for the most part, certainly not in the media. I never had a chance to read our friend Tony Makin's take on the Reserve Bank. I know he wrote an article for Spectator, just like the article I've just written is meant to be published soon by the Spectator Australia. So I'm not sure his exact take, and maybe you can tell me if you've read his article. I'm not sure, Gene, if you can give a little bit of an overview of how he viewed things. But so I just wanted to kind of bring a little bit of an Austrian take to things in terms of, you know, linking sort of, you know, the Reserve Bank, the money supply, and inflation in a nutshell. And also I've found that people often didn't kind of step back and they vaguely mention what the Reserve Bank is supposed to do and kind of leave it at that and just kind of go into and have a very different take than what I wanted to give. So as not only an economist, but also a former law student, I also wanted to kind of start out and go, hey, this is what, you know, the legislation says, for instance, about the Reserve Bank. What they're supposed to do, and then kind of jump in to, you know, like I said, sort of an Austrian economics take on things, and also kind of, you know, stir the hornet's nest a little bit, you know, by using a little bit of satire at the beginning and at the end of the article.
Right. Okay. So yeah, we might get into a few of those things. So, what does the law say? What was your analysis of the legal underpinnings or what they're supposed to do under the Reserve Bank Act?
Yeah. Well, I mean, some people really just don't understand what it is, you know, exactly. You know, it sort of made that clear. This is a central bank. You know, they basically have a monopoly control over currency in Australia. And, you know, people kind of vaguely maybe understand that, but just to make that kind of really clear, you know, this is what it is. It has some other roles, of course. It has, you know, kind of these other banking regulatory functions, but they really, you know, those are really to support the main goal, which is obviously Reserve Bank's not unusual. It's a central bank, very similar to the other central banks around the world, like the Bank of England or the Federal Reserve. But just to remind people, hey, this is, you know, this is a government entity. It has a monopoly on money, essentially. But at the same time, it's required to do, you know, in that context, it has, you know, some of these broader sort of things. It's three main things, you know, where it goes under Section 10A, the stability of the currency, the maintenance of full employment, very, you know, 1940s, 50s sort of thing that was thrown in because, you know, the Reserve Bank Act is from 1959. So, you know, very Keynesian sort of thing there. And the other one kind of, you know, somewhat more vaguely, but, you know, still important, obviously the economic prosperity and welfare of the people of Australia. Now, you know, look, there's only so much you can say in an article, even though my article is a bit longer than your average op-ed, if you like. But there's even within that, there's so much you could say and I couldn't say. But, you know, I'd obviously like to say the audience, so I think they got some issues because these things conflict. Or, you know, you can interpret these things in quite different ways. You know, clearly, I think, you know, I would argue, and I do to some extent, at least I think in my piece, is, you know, certainly printing the sort of amounts of money that they have, and not just recently and not just since COVID, but actually over a much longer period of time, is that, you know, question, you know, I would question that really helps the stability of the currency. You know, that seems to me to be at least something questionable. I think it harms the stability of the currency, but I think it's at least questionable. It also argue that it actually helps out the other two. I don't think it may help with statistical full employment, but does it really help with, you know, economically efficient full employment, much less, you know, actual economic prosperity and welfare?
Yeah.
Sorry. Go ahead.
I was just thinking, it was an interesting point you made about stability of the currency, and you don't think that the growth of the money supply we've seen that the RBA has overseen is consistent with stability of the currency. They've essentially redefined stability of the currency. We now define stability of the currency as not zero inflation. We define it as a 2-3% inflation on average over the economic cycle. So we've accepted a certain... I won't make any judgment, a lower than average, historical average rate of inflation as the target. That's what they're going for. And over the last 30 years, they would argue that they've achieved that, and it's much better than the performance in the post-war period prior to that. So they would argue that they've done a good job at achieving stability of the currency in that regard. But yeah, it just occurred to me that when you said that, that's in the Reserve Bank Act, that they've redefined what stability actually means in using that inflation target.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's fairly easy to pull up what, you know, for instance, CPI looks like, and even though CPI is only accounting for, you know, something like 40% of the economy, you know, it's a big chunk of the economy, but people have this impression that it accounts for 100% of the economy or something like that. So even in that context, it's not a pretty picture, you know, and we're not talking about just like, oh, for a quarter or two or for a year or two. We're talking over, you know, quite long, you know, time frames. You know, we're talking from, you know, basically the 1970s with some flattening out, I would argue, due to some pretty good counter reforms, if you like. Well, not counter reforms, but, you know, reforms that, you know, would counter some of the bad effects of just, you know, kind of having fairly loose monetary policy. And not equally loose throughout that whole period of time, but, you know, Australia really hasn't had a Volcker, for instance, you know, that I'm aware of, in the same sort of time frame that, you know, since, you know, Volcker appeared on the scene in the late 70s and has since left it. So putting aside, you know, again, my piece isn't obviously to go sort of do some technical thing to go like, well, did they meet their own sort of technical requirements? And then just criticize them that way, because there's plenty of articles like that, you know. Mine was to point to the broader thing that just loose money like this. And if you look, I mean, CPI doesn't look good over time, but if you start looking at money supply, whichever one you want to pick, it's not a pretty picture.
Right. Okay. So can I ask what do you mean by an Austrian economics take?
Yeah, look, so for those who don't know, Austrian economics is, I mean, a lot of people, even economists, for some reason, don't fully are aware that there's actually different schools of thought, quite a few different schools of thought. And one of them is the Austrian school. It started with Karl Menger in the sort of mid to late 1800s. He's also attributed along with a couple other economists as kind of, starting the marginal revolution as well. And they call it Austrian school basically because he is actually from Austria. And then some of the other sort of people who followed him, like Baum, Bevirk, Mises, Hayek, et cetera, they were also literally from the country of Austria. So I guess, that stuck, obviously, as the name of the school of thought. I mean, they're very free market. I'd argue that they're certainly the most free market oriented. I'd argue that they're not the most free market oriented because they have an ideological stance. Although you can always say that, certainly like someone like Mises certainly, went to great pains to go like, this is what I think the logic and even the data, even though they're not sort of like, they use data. They don't think data without theory tells you anything. But they would argue that, they take a scientific approach to things like other schools of thought would also argue. And, they have they have the most comprehensive take on understanding money, basically, including, I mentioned Baum, Bevirk, actually Menger even before that, but even from the start, Menger, Baum, Bevirk, and Mises were and still are kind of, the greatest thinkers on money. Some may argue that you could put Keynes in that category. That was one of his, one of his big sort of focuses prior to him writing the general theory. But, the Austrians certainly have a lot to say, and I think a lot of credible things to say, whether you ultimately agree with them or not. I just want to get those kind of ideas, out there in the Australian public.
Okay. And what are those ideas, Darren? And how are they relevant to the RBA review?
Well, look, I mean, in a nutshell, and I've used this quote a million times, it seems, and using Milton Friedman, who's not Austrian, but Chicago school, who him and Anna Schwartz, took an empirical approach, if you like. I mean, I don't think they were setting out to, if you like, test the theories of Mises and people like that as such, but they confirmed that, inflation, it's a monetary phenomenon. And it's always, and at least in practice, maybe the Chicago school don't necessarily agree that in theory, things like central banks are really the root cause of inflation. They certainly agree that in practice, that's what actually happened in history. So, but the Austrians, like I said, they go one step further. They go in great detail to set out the case of why central banks are at the center of why we have ongoing inflation. And the only way you'll ever solve the inflation problem is to do something about central banks. And they would argue you have to do something stronger than just holding them within certain bounds, as the Chicago school would argue.
Right. Okay. And I mean, fiat money is relevant too, isn't it? So you're saying the issue is that you've got a central bank that has the monopoly on fiat money, the monopoly control of the currency, which is fiat money. And they can just print it, they can create it out of thin air. And we saw that during the pandemic in Australia when the RBA finally engaged in quantitative easing. The Federal Reserve had done it previously, the Bank of Japan and Bank of England ECB, but we hadn't actually gone that, we hadn't taken that step yet, but we did during the pandemic.
Well, the Austrians would argue, central banks always are involved in a process of creating money out of nothing. Now, quantitative easing took it to new levels, basically, mechanisms, new levels. And then obviously modern monetary theory sort of opens the floodgates to go further than, quantitative easing would, if you like, allow within that sort of framework of thinking. We may get onto this later on, but the Bank of England produced a couple excellent papers that an Austrian or a neoclassical or a Keynesian or Chicago can all appreciate. It takes something out of just clearly setting out how does a central bank work, but also you know, just as importantly, how does the banking system more broadly, in cooperation, if you like, with the central banks operate? You know, how is money created? I mean, I think the title of the paper is Money Creation in the Modern Economy. You know, that sets it out quite nicely. They have a different view of that. They, of course, they don't think that's an issue as such, you know, provided obviously you stay within certain bounds and all that type of thing. But it does set out the fact that, you know, money is being created from nothing, which is quite a different system to what, you know, say, for instance, the gold standard, you know, the classical gold standard with all its, you know, whatever foibles it had, because Austrians would argue that there could have been a better gold standard, but fine. There was a gold standard, and even central banks, you know, were part of that system previously, if you like. And the Bank of England also nicely sets that out, that history as well.
Yeah.
So basically, again, coming back, you know, the reserve banks, not any different from the Bank of England, Federal Reserve, largely speaking. I mean, there are differences, you know, obviously, you know, the Federal Reserve, obviously they're different size economies, different sizes of the Australian dollar, the US dollar being traded around the world. Obviously, the US dollar is special in the sense that it's still the reserve currency for the world. So, you know, they're prolific money printing. They can get away with it a lot better than, you know, a smaller economy or economies that's not the reserve currency of the world can get away with. Although Australia does punch above its weight, and its currency is traded a lot more than you would expect for a small country because of, you know, it, obviously Australia is a big player in commodities, for instance, and that kind of part of the reason that Australia punches above its weight, if you like.
Okay, we'll take a short break here for a word from our sponsor.
If you need to crunch the numbers, then get in touch with Adept Economics. We offer you frank and fearless economic analysis and advice. We can help you with funding submissions, cost-benefit analysis studies, and economic modelling of all sorts. Our head office is in Brisbane, Australia, but we work all over the world. You can get in touch via our website, www.adepteconomics.com.au. We'd love to hear from you.
Now back to the show.
Now, just on what the RBA review is doing, it has rather a narrow terms of reference. It's looking at the monetary policy framework, inflation targeting. It's looking at the governance, the board, whether we have a separate monetary policy committee. I think that'll end up being one of the recommendations. And the way that John Humphreys described it to me on his Australian Taxpayers Alliance live stream, he just said, well, look, there's an Overton window of what it's going to look at, right? I mean, there's things that are in the Overton window and there's things that are outside. And I think you advocating that they should go outside of that window, they should go outside of what's conventional and actually think about the role of the RBA as a central bank. Is that the type of thing we need? Is that working for us? Or are there alternative approaches? Is that what you're arguing, Darren?
Yeah, look, I think I pull out some recommendations I did when for Liberty Works at the request of Senator Malcolm Roberts, you know, did a submission to his rural banking inquiry because he wanted to get on the record. And so did I, just kind of some of these broader issues of monetary policy and how they do impact the kind of the more narrow review that he was doing at the time. And yeah, I basically suggest, you know, kind of a three-pronged approach, you know, sort of in the shorter term, doing something that, you know, a bit broader than what this current review is doing, but nothing, you know, something that might still be within the Overton window, as you say. And then, you know, what I'm suggesting over the medium term and the longer term are certainly things that, you know, I guess the average policy person, monetary policy person would think would be outside the Overton window. You know, the Overton window, it's a good thing to understand in terms of what is, but it can be a very big obstacle to what should be. Mm. But because I can point to, you know, the reforms, the Hawke and Keating reforms of the mid-1980s were, you know, were not particularly within the Overton window. National competition policy, when it came along in the early 1990s, not quite in the Overton window. There's been a lot of good reforms that are not in the Overton window. Obviously, you know, there's obviously politics involved and making sure that even though it's not quite in the Overton window, that, you know, that you don't scare the horses too much. And people who've been pushing things in the direction of more and more government interference in the economy, including, if you like, the more draconian stuff, you know, the over-the-top lockdowns, the censorship, all these sorts of things. Putting aside the fact, I know a lot of censorship are done by private companies, but they're done by the behest of government. And they're done by the behest of government. If you don't do it, you know, there'll be trouble for you, private company. So, you know, it's certainly not, I don't think, you know, the libertarians who suggested that, oh, it's private property, so it doesn't matter. That's not right. So, you know, people on the left, in a nutshell, don't care a rat's butt about the Overton window for the most part. They keep on plugging away, and they're largely winning. So, which is why I wanted to point out some of these reforms, if you like, went more in the direction of the right, center right, for instance, including, you know, a labor government and including, you know, some liberal governments in the past. Things can be done. So the Overton window, you got to be aware of it. You got to understand it. And it's something you need to deal with, but it shouldn't be something that just stops you from doing something.
Right. And so what would the Austrians recommend? Abolition of the central bank? I mean, what would happen? What would you recommend?
Well, look, you know, look, the Austrians, there's quite a variety of
okay.
views even. But then, look, you know, there's a sort of a Hayek, sort of like competing currency approach. There's the Rothbard's more, let's do a new and improved version of the gold standard, if you like. Obviously, these things are digitized. No one's ever suggesting that, you know, that we carry hunks of gold. And look, that's fine if you want to carry hunks of gold with you. You know, it's probably not going to be a huge market for that. That's going to be, but I mean, they recognized that centuries ago anyway. It's not like, you know, the gold standard really, there were people running around with bits of gold with them all the time. That was never the case, you know, because the goldsmiths figured out before the official gold standard came around that, hey, certificates seem to be a little bit more convenient, you know, which that's where actually money came from.
Yeah.
You know, paper money, I should say. Sorry, paper
yeah,
money
yeah.
came from those certificates. So John Humphreys, he always has a bee in his bonnet about Murray Rothbard, in particular, his argument that he considers, you know, today's system of fractional reserve banking to be fraud, you know, from a common law perspective. You know, Rothbard's not arguing literally in the laws and the books that it's actually fraud. He's saying that under common law, this would be considered fraud. Yeah, okay, maybe not. But certainly the market wouldn't allow a whole lot of fractional reserve banking. I'm sure there won't be like a one-on-one alignment all the time, you know, between, you know, reserves and loans and all that sort of stuff. That's fine. But there wouldn't be such a huge disconnect that we have. You know, we're talking 90% and above disconnect between, you know, say savings and what's being lent out. Getting back to sort of Rothbard is not given sort of credit for being more practical than he was. Yeah, he goes like, here's the ideal I want. Yeah, you get rid of central banks and fractional reserve banking. But any little step in that direction could be, hey, how about as a start, let's just audit this thing. And, you know, like they talk about in the US sometimes, let's just audit the Federal Reserve.
Yeah.
What are they up to? How do they do things? Let the public know this is what it is. You know, are you happy with this? Does this make sense? You know?
Yeah.
Are you happy with the inflationary consequences? Are you happy with the fact that, I mean, this thing is very inequitable. You know, like it causes the booms and busts as well, at least from an Austrian perspective. Because inflation and bubbles, it's the same thing. Inflation doesn't uniformly happen. It ends up in asset bubbles. It goes over here, it goes over there. Some people can make, you know, a killing out of really not being very good at what they do. They're just in the right place at the right time. You know, we're not talking about discouraging proper entrepreneurialism. Sometimes, you know, this is kind of like, you know, sort of not very good, sloppy, property-oriented sort of entrepreneurialism. And there's a lot of kind of transfers from the poor to the rich. I mean, let's just get that all out there in a report. I'll be happy with multiple views, you know, a red versus blue type of approach. Yeah. Hey, what do the Keynesians think of this? You know, what do the Austrians think of this? What do the neoclassicals think of this? You know, get it all out there and, you know, just make it more transparent would be a great start rather than this kind of, you know, tweaking at the edges. There's basically a lot of people in political and business power who obviously like the system as it is.
Or they don't want to, I mean, yeah, they haven't really thought too deeply about it. Yeah, they don't want to rock the boat too much, perhaps. I think we might have to come back to Rothbard's views. That sounds interesting, and because we probably don't have enough time to go into it now. But, yeah, I think it'd be worth coming back to that because, yeah, I'm all for a more wider-ranging review. I think it'd be fascinating. I think we chatted about this last time we caught up, but we hadn't seen the terms of reference yet to the review, and I think you predicted that it'd be quite narrow and it'd be very... yeah, you'd get standard sort of mainstream economists on it, as we ended up doing. I'm not critical of any of them, I think. But yeah, they could have had a broader terms of reference for sure.
Just one thing to say, that the Rothbard, you know, some people go, oh, look, you know, you're kind of in your libertarian utopia. You don't understand how the system works. He wrote the very best book on how banking works. Modern Banking.
What's the book called? Modern Banking, is it?
No, it's called The Mystery of Banking.
The Mystery of Banking. Okay.
It is in great detail exactly how... So it's basically the Bank of England, you know, they don't refer to the mystery of banking, but they did a very good job of doing something smaller. They got some really good graphics, you know, in the Bank of England report. But they're very much aligned. They just have different conclusions. You know, obviously they don't come to the same conclusion that Rothbard does.
Right, yeah. I mean, that's the article where they describe how the banks essentially, they're at the vanguard of creating money, or they're the money supply is endogenous to an extent, because the banks are extending credit, and when they're extending more new loans than are paid back, then that's an expansion of the money supply. Now, the central bank's involved. The central bank can influence the money supply, but the private banks are heavily involved in it, and I think that's what they're arguing with. It's that endogenous view of the money supply, and yeah, I think it is worth reading. What was the main takeaway for you out of it, Darren? What the Bank of England wrote? I'm just trying to remember what was in those articles.
The main takeaway wasn't like, wow, I'm surprised this is how they do it. My main takeaway was, wow, I'm surprised they said it. And I guess another wow is, wow, thank you. That's, you know, they explained it really well. It was a really clear, I mean, Rothbard's book, Mystery of Banking, is really big, you know? So it's a tome. It's huge. So, it, you know, the Bank of England's report has both an introduction, if you don't want to read the more detailed report, but even the more detailed report is nowhere near the size of the Mystery of Banking. But they're all saying the same thing in terms of like describing the process, right? You know, what do central banks do? What do the commercial banks do? I mean, so basically the thing, you know, when right away when someone gets a loan, that's money already. So you've just increased the money supply right there.
Yeah.
They don't need things to happen. It's right there. They whack it in your bank account. Obviously, people do all sorts of different things with that.
Yeah.
But yeah, right there. So there is one thing. I must admit, I figured, you know, fractional reserve banking or those banks creating money, I knew that I was, you know, over time, I was trying to understand that they were actually creating most of the money. It wasn't the central banks themselves. But when I saw the Bank of England, I didn't realize the percentage was quite as big as it is. They said 97%. 97% of all money.
Yeah.
In the UK, and it won't be very different from, you know, going to any Western country. It's probably all going to be the 90s to some extent. Was this, you know, they actually used the term fountain pen money.
Mm. Yeah. Okay.
So I guess I was even surprised at the size.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And so you see that as a confession or just acknowledgement of the Bank of England, by the Bank of England, of how the money supply can grow, and you're taking from that the system that we have naturally leads to expansion of the money supply and to inflation. Is that what you're inferring from that, Darren?
Yeah, well, basically it's that. It's even more than that. It is literally inflation, but obviously there's certain levels of inflation. You know, they can be vary quite a bit. I think it incentivizes, you know, high inflation, or certainly it certainly incentivized booms and busts. I wouldn't say necessarily it was a confession or anything like that, but they do actually, you know, early on in the report, take the myth that I certainly read in my economic textbooks, you know, that basically banks are just purely these intermediaries who get savings and then lend them out and obviously take a little bit of a cut. Okay, fine. That's fine. I don't have a problem with that as a business.
Yeah.
They basically knock that on the head.
Yeah.
But interestingly enough, they don't do it in a way that they say this is bad. But for me, I read it and go, you know, because of my kind of Austrian take on things, I go, well, that's not good. You know, they're just saying this is what it is. Basically, it's not this. They're not just simply intermediaries. This is what these banks are. And this is how we as a central bank interact with those banks. Again, I think any economist of any school of thought would find it, you know, an informative paper.
Oh, absolutely. I've talked about it on the show before. I'll put some links in the show notes. I think it's a good paper. And yeah, I'll link to your Spectator article once it's out. Oh, gee, Darren, there's so much to talk about. Really appreciate your time. We dealt with some big issues and we've still got more to talk about. Certainly, I want to come back to Rothbard. Yeah, that's. I'll have to have a read of his book and Mystery of Banking. And really appreciate your time. So, thanks once more for coming on to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, I hope you found that informative and enjoyable. I welcome Darren's call for a broader review of the Reserve Bank of Australia. Given the importance of the Reserve Bank in the economy, we should be thinking about what presuppositions we're making about the bank and we should subject them to critical thought. The current review of the bank appears to take for granted that the Reserve Bank should continue as an entity and it should retain its extensive powers under the Reserve Bank Act. The review focuses on the appropriateness of the inflation targeting regime and the governance of the bank, but it should be much broader. The review's terms of reference noted explicitly that the review will exclude the RBA's payments, financial infrastructure, banking, and banknote functions. Arguably, it would have been desirable to review even these functions of the RBA. So I think Darren is on the right track here, even if I disagree with him over what a broader review would recommend. There are at least two big related questions that a wider review would consider. First, do we need a central bank? That is, do we need a government-owned or authorised bank which acts as a bank for other banks and is ultimately responsible for the currency? Secondly, would commodity-backed money, where money is convertible to gold at a fixed rate, would that be preferable to fiat money, where money is decreed to be the legal tender of the land by the government, and the money supply is the responsibility of the central bank? In a way, fiat money presupposes a central bank or an arm of government such as the Treasury, which effectively acts as a bank. But a central bank can exist in a commodity money system too, and indeed several, such as the Bank of England and US Federal Reserve, they did exist during the years in which the gold standard was in place, or some of the years in which the gold standard was in place. A central bank can perform an important role regardless of the monetary standard in place. As the 19th century British polymath Walter Badgett illustrated in Lombard Street, a central bank can perform an important role by acting as a lender of last resort. That is, lending to banks when they temporarily get into trouble and saving those banks from collapsing and causing lots of hardship. My view is that a central bank is an indispensable part and an unavoidable part of a modern economy. Regarding the second big question, I wouldn't recommend a return to commodity money by, say, reintroducing a gold standard, but I will concede that advocates of a gold standard have some good arguments on their side. These arguments are even more appealing in times of high inflation, such as the time we're now living in. Most importantly, in my view, it is clear that fiat money systems are much more prone to inflation than commodity money systems. A 1998 study by economists at the Minneapolis Fed found that the average inflation rate for the fiat standard observations, so this is observations in the data set they're analysing, the average inflation rate for the fiat standard observations is 9.17% per year. The average inflation rate for the commodity standard observations is 1.75%. That's a big difference. The data set they use contained data on 15 countries, including the US, UK, France, Italy, Germany, Spain, Argentina, and Brazil, among others. Every country in the data set had a higher rate of inflation under a fiat standard than a commodity standard. What's going on is that obviously there are physical constraints on the amount of commodity money available. It's limited by the rate at which it can be discovered, dug up, and produced. Under a fiat standard, new money is virtually costless to produce. As Darren and I discussed, the central bank and commercial banks are both involved in new money creation, and it's possible for the money supply to expand faster than the productive capacity of the economy, leading to inflation. There can be too much money chasing too few goods. This is not to say that you can't have inflation in a commodity money system. For example, there was prolonged inflation in Spain and in the UK in the 16th and 17th centuries due to new silver mining in Mexico and Peru following European conquest. Still, as the Minneapolis Fed economists point out, the average inflation rates over the period in these countries, it was only around 1 to 1.2% over 100 to 150 years. That's 1 to 1.2% per annum. I'll link to that study in the show notes so you can check it out. To me, it really clearly shows that fiat money systems are much more prone to inflation, and you end up with inflation at higher rates than under a commodity money system. While a commodity standard would yield better inflation outcomes than a fiat standard, it would be very difficult to return to, say, the gold standard. US President Reagan appointed a gold commission in 1981 to consider whether the US should return to the gold standard. The majority of the commission rejected such a move, and prominent economists such as Milton Friedman and Alan Greenspan, they advised Reagan against a return to gold. Greenspan did, however, suggest issuing some US Treasury bonds backed by gold, something which would provide some fiscal discipline. He did not, however, advocate a full return to the gold standard. Greenspan thought that a return to the gold standard would be impractical given the nature of the modern economy with a large role for government and a welfare state. A gold standard requires fiscal discipline for several reasons, which I might have to cover in a bonus episode. One of these reasons is that under a gold standard, a government can't rely on future inflation to erode the real value of the debt it owes. In his 2007 autobiography, The Age of Turbulence, Greenspan wrote the following: "I have always harbored a nostalgia for the gold standard's inherent price stability. A stable currency was its primary goal. But I've long since acquiesced in the fact that the gold standard does not readily accommodate the widely accepted current view of the appropriate functions of government, in particular the need for government to provide a social safety net. The propensity of Congress to create benefits for constituents without specifying the means by which they are to be funded has led to deficit spending in every fiscal year since 1970, with the exception of the surpluses of 1998 to 2001 generated by the stock market boom. The shifting of real resources required to perform such functions has imparted a bias toward inflation. In the political arena, the pressure to make low interest rate credit generally available and to use fiscal measures to boost employment and to avoid the unpleasantness of downward adjustments in nominal wages and prices has become nearly impossible to resist. For the most part, the American people have tolerated the inflation bias as an acceptable cost of the modern welfare state. There is no support for the gold standard today, and I see no likelihood of its return." Austrian economists would say that Greenspan gave in to big government and to inflation, and there may be some truth in that. But Greenspan's position is entirely pragmatic. I'll put some links in the show notes so you can learn more about this fascinating episode of the Gold Commission and about Friedman's and Greenspan's advice to Reagan. I'll also add a link to the minority report of the commission, which recommended a return to the gold standard. It was co-authored by Ron Paul, the noted libertarian politician. I'll leave it there for now, but I recognize there are several aspects of monetary economics that I need to explore and explain some more. I think the process of money creation and how the central bank can influence the money supply would be good to go over in some depth, as it's challenging to understand. My conversation with Darren also reminded me that it would be good to look at how we ended up with inflation targeting in the first place. Why do we think it's sensible to have a 2 to 3% inflation target rather than a zero target? I hope you'll forgive me if I leave these questions to a future episode. Among other topics, in coming episodes, I'll have a closer look at the growing US-China tensions and the rise of authoritarianism around the world. Geopolitics obviously can have a big impact on economies, so I think it's important that I cover it on this show. If there are topics you'd like me to cover in future episodes, please let me know. As always, feel free to email me at contact@economicsexplored.com. Thanks for listening.
Righto, thanks for listening to this episode of Economics Explored. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please get in touch. I'd love to hear from you. You can send me an email via contact@economicsexplored.com or a voicemail via SpeakPipe. You can find the link in the show notes. If you've enjoyed the show, I'd be grateful if you could tell anyone you think would be interested about it. Word of mouth is one of the main ways that people learn about the show. Finally, if your podcasting app lets you, then please write a review and leave a rating. Thanks for listening. I hope you can join me again next week.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the episode. For more content like this, or to begin your own podcasting journey, head on over to obsidian-productions.com.